Hi, everybody. My name is Charlie Farman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Charlie.
Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found necessary to take a drink for 6,575 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. And it's sure good to be in Denton, Texas. We get every weekend where we look forward to these more and more and more, because now it's getting to be everywhere we go, we see some old friends that we've met before and been with before and shared before. And before we leave here this weekend, we're going to make a lot of new friends also. I'm sure about that. I always like to see these couple of these fellas sitting on the front row here. It's good to see a plain old drunk, you know, and two of them sitting up here on the front row from plain old Texas. I always like that. Joe and I do not consider ourselves to be the gurus of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't consider ourselves to be the experts in anything at all. We're just two guys that met together some years ago, found that we had a mutual interest in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, began to study it together, and hopefully we've learned a few things about it, and we just love to have the opportunity to share what knowledge we do have with other alcoholics. We do not speak for AA as a whole. You are most certainly free to agree or disagree with anything that we say as you see fit. And if you hear us say anything that can't be reconciled with what's in the Big Book or other AA conference approved material, we'd suggest that you just disregard that part of our program. Mainly, we'll try to keep it all on the Big Book itself. We try to keep this thing just as informal as we possibly can. Now, we love to laugh. We really mean and believe that the book is right when it says we're meant to be joyous, happy, and free. We love to tell jokes. We love to enjoy people. So during the whole weekend, one of our major things is going to be just on plain old informality. And I think we'll find there's a lot of humor in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous if we can really look at it and kind of figure out what Bill was talking about in some cases. There's a lot of places where we can laugh and where we can have a lot of fun. Now, we are the first to know that the mind will only absorb about what the rear end will stand. And some of these sessions will become quite long. Most of them we take a break after about an hour, hour and a half. Tonight we probably won't. We always like to get through this first session without it keeping everybody up and out too long. So tonight, we probably won't break tonight, but any time during a session, if you feel the need to get up and walk around a little bit, please feel free to do that. It won't bother us at all. If you feel the need to get up and go get a cup of coffee, please feel free to do that also. If you feel the need to get up and go get rid of a cup of coffee, that's fine too. It won't bother us at all, except we'll be watching you when you go through the door over here. I always like to do that and then look at them as they come out and see that sense of satisfaction on their face.
That sense of ease and comfort.
That sense of ease and comfort they experience in there. So what we need to do, I think, is all of us just relax and have a good, fun, enjoyable weekend and hopefully learn something about the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, Joe.
My name is Joe and I'm a real alcoholic. Through God's grace and because this program works each day of my life. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since March the 10th, 1962, and for this I'm grateful. It's good, as Charlie said, to be here for another Big Book study and see some old faces and get back into the Big Book. As Charlie said, that we like to really tell you a little bit, hope everybody understands where we're coming from. We're just two members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some years ago, I became interested in the Big Book. It was a fascinating time in my life as I began to work with people about, I guess it was 17 years ago. And I felt a great need to learn more about the program. At that time, you know, I had been sober probably 8 years. I felt pretty complete, as we all do in the program all the time, and complacent. But as I began to work with people, I felt, for some reason or another, a great inadequacy in my life to do what I was doing. So I didn't know anything else to do, so I began to study on the Big Book. After being sober 8 years, I picked up the big book, studying it for a different reason. And as I studied it, you know, I began to see some design in the book and the structure of the book, and I began to talk to people about it in my AA community there in Little Rock, and I found that very few people, you know, I couldn't find anybody to talk to. Wasn't anybody interested in the big book? That's a shame when you can't find somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous interested in the big book. And I tried to talk to them, and finally I think I could become somewhat of a pest. In fact, then when they saw me coming, they said, "Here he comes," and they'd run, you know. But so I begin to wonder, well, you know, because these people had more sobriety than I did, and maybe been around a long time, and I begin to wonder, you know, maybe they are right. Maybe, you know, they said, "We don't need to know how it works. We just need to know it works." Maybe I was wrong, and it was about that time, after about a year, that I met Charlie, and I always talk about this as a memorable night in my AA life, that it was an Al-Anon conference. I was asked to introduce a speaker at an Al-Anon conference, and I had never met Charlie before, and he and his wife were going to speak, and they asked me would I introduce him, and I always tell about how, you know, that night I introduced him, I told him I was very disappointed in the speaker, because I hadn't met the guy, and I heard his name was Charlie P, and I thought it was going to be Charlie Pride. And this guy wasn't even the right color. And he couldn't sing either. But I introduced him that night, and as soon as the meeting was over, a large group of people come up, you know, and talk to the speaker, and they talked, and I stood around and to, you know, talk to him after it was all over, and after we got talking after the meeting, I went to talk to him about the big book. Like I always did, I bring that subject up. And sure enough, Charlie was interested in the big book. In fact, he was the first person I knew was interested in the book. I mean, in fact, I said, well, I better hang on to this guy. Yeah. So we became really that night instant friends over the big book. We made some kind of tentative plans to do some things, I guess, to meet as we met there. And after that weekend, we would meet at different conferences and discuss the big book. And then we got to where we began to make notes. Well, we were separated. We would make notes and we'd compare our notes. And as we would put the big book study together, it wasn't a big book study then. We had no intentions of doing what we're doing now. We were just interested in learning something about the book. Other people begin to hear about, you know, how everybody knows what you're doing. And some of the other guys at the different conferences heard that we were discussing the book. And so the third guy asked, Charlie asked one time, "You mind if this other guy sets in?" It was Tony. And I said, "No, I don't mind." Then after that, a number of other people would come into the room and we would be sitting around just discussing the big book with them. A lot of times during that period of time, the first couple of years, you know, I would go to Charlie's farm and spend a weekend on the farm, and we had some memorable weekends there studying the big book. This began by 1973, and we did this for 4 years of study on the book and spending time like this together, comparing notes on the book. And finally, it was in 1977, and during one of these particular conferences, there was a guy in there named Joe, too. He was from Lawton, Oklahoma. And he said, "You know, this is good." He said, I think some of my group would like to hear this." He said, "Well, y'all come out and do this for my group." So sure enough, we did, and someone taped that. And this is where the first big book tapes were made. And a taper at home got hold of these tapes, and he decided that he would... We said that he had them on a reel, and he decided he would put them on four little tapes to see if anybody else would like to have some of them. And he called it tapes, the big book study tapes. So our name came off of the tapes. And these tapes went out, and we were invited, Charlie then were invited to many other places over a period from 1977 until 1980. We would go around and do six or seven, eight big book studies a year. And in 1979, we met a guy in Omaha, Nebraska. Everybody knows he's passed on, a guy named Wesley Parrish. Weston Parris was a great student of the big book and had Prince studying the book way before Charlie and I were even in the program. And he was very enthused, and you have to understand if you had to know what type of student Wes had been in the book for so many years. But he'd never been able to totally unlock the textbook and the concepts that Charlie and I could see it. And we met him one night in Omaha, Nebraska. In fact, we were doing a big book study up there, and he came up there to speak that Saturday night, and he had never heard a big book study. And I can remember his face now as the big book study began. You could see his eyes light up. And during the break, he came up and he asked us, he said, "Where in the hell did y'all come from?" And he was kind of peeved that he had been studying the book for so many years and never completely had been able to unlock it. But I think, you know, with Charlie and I talk about that, it was, it was hard to do anything with one mind. It took two minds, to really look at this thing to come up. I don't think one person could ever have accumulated the concept. And Wes was by himself as he studied. And he was fascinated by it, and he asked us, he called me up that Monday and called Charlie and wanted to know what he could do with the tapes. And we told him we don't have anything to do with the tapes. That's, he could do what he wanted to do. And finally, in 1980, he worked at this, and he'd done a lot of things. He sent the tapes to a lot of people. He was really fascinated about getting this message to Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 1980, Wester was, they had the conference in New Orleans, and Wester was the chairman of the luncheon that Wednesday, the international luncheon. And he had 15 guests at this luncheon, and he asked Charlie and I, could he give away some of these tapes as door prizes?
1,500 guests.
1,500 guests, rather. Not 1,500. But so what Wester did, he gave away these tapes as door prizes, and what he did, he actually, these people didn't really win the tapes. Wesley picked them out, because he knew where everyone would be seated. So he picked out the people he wanted to win the tapes. And he picked out people from all over the country, quite naturally, in different communities and all over the world. And as these tapes went out, Charlie and I then were doing, say, 5 or 6 big book studies, and this is what really got other people across the country into the big book tapes. And since then, Charlie and I have been, wish we could gather up some of those tapes. But we have had the opportunity to go to many, many places. And this is a fascinating experience in Alcoholics Anonymous as we go from different places doing the big book study. And we were, like I say, last year we did about 37 big book studies. All over the United States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand. And we will do a little over 30, 34, 35 this year. But it's just simply, it's an experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think it's one of the greatest experiences of our lives is to have the opportunity to go so many places with the thing that's so important to our lives, the big book, and be a part of so many people's lives in the AA community. I think one of the greatest opportunities that an Alcoholics Anonymous can get to be invited into somebody's AA community. So it has been a fascinating experience, and it's all through the big book Alcoholics Anonymous.
When we got to go to the Bahamas to do a big book study, and we did it in Nassau, and one day we were walking down the street, had a little free time, and we were doing a little shopping, and Joe turned to me and he said, "Charlie," said, "have you noticed how these people are looking at us strangely?" And I said, "Yeah, I have." And he said, "They looking at you this time." Never even crossed my mind, but they sure as hell were. In studying the big book, we got to go back for just a few minutes to the beginning of the book, and in order to kind of see the purpose of the book and what really was behind it. And I always drop back to the summer of 1937. In a house on Ardmore Avenue in Akron, Ohio, there was two drunks sitting in the kitchen, probably drinking coffee, and they were talking about what had taken place in their lives in the last 3 or 4 years prior to that time. They talked about the time Bill Wilson went to the town's hospital in the summer of 1933, and where there he was withdrawn from alcohol by this fellow named Dr. Silkworth, and how Dr. Silkworth had explained to Bill this thing called the disease of alcoholism, where he explained to Bill that it was not weak will, that it was not moral character, it was not sin, that it was an actual disease, and a twofold disease at that. He talked to Bill about the physical allergy of the body, which we'll go into in some detail when we get to the doctor's opinion. And he also talked to Bill about the obsession of the mind, which we're really going to see when we get into chapter 3. He said, Bill, you have become physically allergic to alcohol. You do not react like normal people. When you take a drink, it triggers a craving in your body that makes it virtually impossible for you to stop after you have once started drinking. He says, also, you have developed an obsession of the mind that is so strong that it makes you believe something that isn't true. It makes you believe that you can drink and get by with it okay. And he said, doesn't make any difference how bad you want to stop. From time to time, the obsession of the mind will tell you it's okay to drink. And then you'll drink, and you'll trigger the allergy, and then you'll be unable to stop drinking. He said, you have developed a hopeless condition of the mind and of the body. He said, you can't drink because of the allergy, and you can't quit because of the obsession of the mind. Bill left the town's hospital in the summer of 1933 with a full knowledge of his disease. And he said, now that I know what's wrong with me, I'll never have to drink again. We know shortly thereafter, though, that Bill got drunk again. And they talked about the fact that he drank for another year and went back to the town's hospital in the summer of 1934. And Dr. Silkworth this time pronounced him as absolutely incurable, told Bill's wife that he's going to die very shortly. He'll either die from heart failure during DTs or he will go permanently insane and you'll have to lock him up, one of the two. And Bill left that hospital in the summer of 1934 and fear sobered him up for a bit. But they also talked about the fact that toward the end of November of that year, that Bill's mind told him that it would be okay to drink. And he took a drink and triggered the allergy and couldn't stop drinking. So it was obvious knowledge of the disease really didn't stop his alcoholism. Fear didn't stop his alcoholism. Bill continued to drink during that month of November. And finally, he was visited by a fellow named Eddie Thatcher. And Eddie brought to Bill two other pieces of information. He told Bill about a group of people that he had been going to their particular fellowship called the Oxford Groups. And he said, with any Oxford Groups, I have learned from a fellow named Roland Hazard that the solution to this problem that you and I have, Bill, is a vital spiritual experience. He just said, during that vital spiritual experience, people like us can find the power, not only greater than alcohol, but also greater than human power. And that power can overcome the disease of alcoholism, if we can find it. And he said, these Oxford Group people have shown me a little practical program of action and guaranteed me if I would use it, I could find that power. And he said, Bill, I hadn't had a drink in 2 months. Now, this was really something because Bill knew about Ebby, and he knew about how Ebby drank. And the idea that Ebby had been sober 2 months was really something for Bill to realize. He invited Bill to go with him to the Oxford Group meetings, even though Bill was drinking. After a short period of time, Bill got all the way down, put back in the town's hospital in December of 1934, and he was visited there by Ebby. And he and Eddie applied this practical program of action to the best of their ability in Bill's life. And Bill, what he had, what he always referred to as a vital spiritual experience, is the result of that program of action. And we don't know for sure what took place, but we do know that was about December the 10th, 1934. And we do know that Bill didn't die until January of 1971, and it was never necessary for him to take another drink. We also know that Bill was visiting in Akron, Ohio on a business trip. And the business trip fell through. And Bill was in the lobby of a large hotel there in Akron, very low, very depressed, looking in the bar, thinking about if I could go in there and order me a soda, that I'd have some companionship and I wouldn't feel so bad. But his mind said, Bill, if you go in that bar, you're going to have a drink. And if you do, you're going to get drunk and blow the whole deal. So Bill, in desperation, had made a few phone calls. And a lady that he finally got hold of put him in contact with this other fella that they were sitting there talking in that kitchen, this fella named Bob Smith. And Bill had taken to Dr. Bob Smith this idea of the disease of alcoholism. And Dr. Bob immediately bought into that idea. Absolutely blows our mind today when we think about this. Here's this old conning, manipulating, speculating, New York City stock speculator. They called him a stock broker. He was a stock speculator. Sitting down with a well-known surgeon and explained to the surgeon what was wrong with his mind and what was wrong with his body. Normally the surgeon said, who in the hell are you to be telling me what's wrong with my mind and my body? But the information had such depth and interest that Dr. Bob bought into it immediately. And they found that Dr. Bob had already been going to the Oxford groups, already been trying to find a power outside of himself. And Dr. Bob now began to apply that little practical program of action in his life, and he recovered also. They reviewed how they had gone immediately after Dr. Bob's recovery to a hospital there in Akron to speak to a fellow named Bill Dotson, and how they sat down with Bill Dotson and told Bill the things they had learned. They told Bill what the problem was, the physical allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind. They told Bill Dotson what the solution was, his vital spiritual experience, the power greater than human power. And they told Bill Dotson the third thing, the practical program of action. Bill applied the action in his life, and lo and behold, he recovered also. And they continued to work in Akron with alcoholics during that summer of 1935. Eventually, Bill had to go back to New York City. He left behind him in Akron what was to later become the first group of Alcoholics Anonymous. New York City, he began to work with drunks again there. And one, two, and three of those began to get sober, and they were forming what was to later become the second group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some drunks up in Cleveland had heard about these strange drunks down in Akron. The Cleveland people came down, and the Akron people told them the same three things. What is the problem? What is the solution? And what is the practical program of action? The Cleveland people went back home, and two or three of them began to apply the program of action in their life, and lo and behold, they recovered also. And they were forming what was to later become the third group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, in this summer of 1937, Bill and Bob were sitting there reviewing what had taken place. And they decided to count the number of heads that they knew of that were staying sober on these three pieces of information. And to their amazement, they realized approximately 40 people were staying sober on this information. And I'm almost sure, being good drunks, probably Bill turned to Bob and said, what do you think we ought to do about this? And Bob probably said, beats the hell out of me, Bill. What do you think we ought to do? Maybe this was the first time the group conscious began to work, because they decided that they wouldn't answer that question. They called a meeting of all the alcoholics in Akron, and 18 of them met together to determine what to do about this information. They decided to do three things. First thing they decided to do was to build a chain of hospitals stretching throughout the world so that every alcoholic would always have treatment right at their fingertips. Second thing they decided to do was to hire and train a group of alcoholic missionaries and send them over the entire world to carry the message to those that were trying to recover. The third thing they decided to do was to write a book. And the purpose of the book was to do two things. First, it was to supply the funds necessary to build the hospitals and train the missionaries. Thank God that didn't work. Also, it was to put down the information that these 40 people had learned in order to recover from their disease of alcoholism. And it was to be put down in the same manner and in the same sequence that they themselves had to learn it. They first had to learn what is the problem. They next had to learn what is the solution, and they next had to learn what is the program of action. And as we study the book this weekend, we're going to try to always keep in mind that the book really is divided into these three sections, showing us first the problem, then the solution, and then the practical program of action. And they decided to put that down in a written form so it would not become garbled and it would not be changed in the future. Thank God it has remained pure from the day they first put it down when the book was published in 1939. Joe?
Okay, we go to...
Notice I've got a hell of a cold. I don't know how long I'm going to last, but we're going to keep trying it.
He'll last. Okay, now we'll start off with a table of contents of the book and look at those three things that Charlie had just talked about. And this is the great simplicity of the book. And we'll be talking about, you know, and I think that we see that our book is, this is not a new concept in which the book is written. It's the same old areas in which we use to solve problems. We're going to be looking at three things, and we'll look at the chapters of the book. We will look at the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. These two... Other row. They'll get it. There she is. Kill my electricity? Yeah. Kill the mic.
I leave the other side on, and I think it'll be all right. See if it will.
How's it now? Nope. So.
Turn it back on, I guess.
Well, they can look at the outline.
Are you going to be able to see it all right?
No. Is the mic off? Mic on now?
The mic's on the same. There you go.
Now, how's that? Mic still on? Yeah.
Can't see nothing.
Can't see it. Well, I think we need the mic. Okay, well, you have the outline. You can look at the one that you have. And we'll be talking about these three goals or the three areas of the big book. What is the problem? The first goal is what is the problem? First thing we got to find, and in problem solving, the first step in recovery or solving any problem is find out what is the problem. And we'll learn that this affirmation is the basic of everything we're going to be using this week. What is the problem? Now, we'll use a doctor's opinion in Bill's story. This is a section of the textbook that deals with what is the problem. And a problem statement, there's a problem statement. The problem is the first step. The problem statement is that the powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. That is a statement of the problem. And once we understand the problem, then we can come to the second section of the book, the second step. There is a solution. In the chapters, there is a solution more about alcoholism and we agnostics. In these three chapters, we will find the solution to the problem. Now, once we establish those two points, now this is why the first two steps is the foundation for the main purpose of the book is recovery. Now, once we have established what is the problem and what is the solution, then the main purpose then is to enable us to find that solution. And that's the planned program of action, how it works, into action and work with others. It's in these three chapters that we find the 10 steps to recovery, the recovery plan or the planned program of action. And this is based on the first two steps. And this is the main purpose of the book, which contains the most steps. So we'll begin with what is the problem, then what is the solution to the problem, and then how do we find a solution. If we want to simplify it a little further, we'll look at the first step. It's very simple. We can boil the first step down to one word. It's powerless. Powerless. And obvious, if you're powerless, then The solution is one word, power. And if you're powerless and the solution is power, then the main job is how do we find that power? That's the 10 steps. So it's really powerless, power, how do we find that power?
Later on in the book, we will see a statement that says the main object to this book is to enable us to find a power greater than ourselves. So we can see if our problem is powerlessness, and the answer or the solution is power, that if we can find that power, we'd be okay. And the last 10 steps tell us how to find that power. And we'll be looking at that as we go through the book all the way. Let's look at the preface for just a moment. A couple of short ideas. It says this is the third edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The first edition appeared in April of 1939. And in the following 16 years, more than 300,000 copies went into circulation. The second edition, published in 1955, reached a total of more than 1,150,000 copies. Because this book has become the basic text for our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for both the second and the third editions. Two ideas, very briefly. Number one, it says it's become the basic text for our society. And I think when we see those words, we're alerted to the type book that we have in front of us. It calls it a text, or it is a textbook. Now, many of us have an aversion to the words textbook because we didn't like them when we went to school. They meant work. They meant doing things you didn't want to do. They meant taking tests and the possibility of failure. And many of us really, really began to have an aversion against that thing called a textbook. But I think if we look at a textbook in its simplest terms or form, what it really is a method of conveying information. Taking information from the mind of one human being or a group of human beings, transferring it to the mind of other human beings by the written word, thereby increasing the knowledge of the other human being. And that's all teaching really is. And that's all our textbook here is going to do for us. It's going to teach us about the disease of alcoholism. It's going to teach us about this power greater than we are. And it's going to teach us a method of finding that power. And it's simply a method of transferring information. All textbooks are written with the idea that the user of the book will have limited knowledge about the subject. And it usually starts at a very simple level. And as we progress through the book, the information becomes more and more difficult. Thank you, Joe.
Got it. Okay, now, as Charlie said, a textbook is a book that's going to convey information. And we were talking about the story of the first 100. The 100 people were covered, and they wanted to convey that information to us in the same way that they had to learn it. Now, and a textbook usually begins at a simpler level. And we always use the illustration as just like a math textbook. Now, you know, if we would go open up a math textbook and we would open it up to chapter 5, and in chapter 5, it would be talking about algebra. If you were a brand new reader and knew nothing about mathematics, and you open it up to algebra, you would be pretty confused. The chances are you would lay that book down, you would try to do it, but you would lay that book down and leave it alone, and you could never deal with that. But say if you would go to the front of the book, and you would open up that textbook and with someone's help, and they would tell you to just do the first part of it, and you would learn simple addition. I think that's very, very important because, you know, once you learn addition, Addition is basic to mathematics, because once you learn addition, addition teaches you the values of numbers. And if you don't know the values of numbers, there's no math at all that you can work. And once you learn to add, then you can learn to subtract. Because if you don't know the values of numbers, you cannot subtract. And after you learn to subtract, you can learn to multiply. And after you learn all three of those, it takes all three of those to learn divisions. And after you get divisions, it takes all three of those, adding, multiplication, division together, then you can start on fractions. And after you got through fractions and learned something about decimals and then got to chapter 5, then you could probably go into chapter 5 and you could learn algebra. Now this is the way that this is a textbook too, just like a math book. It starts out in a simpler level to teach the reader. And it works this way. This is why we think one of the greatest mistakes in AA today is people are giving people the big book and say, go to chapter 5 and start off and you'll be all right. And the guy opens a book, or whoever it is, he opens a book and it goes into chapter 5 and he reads the 12 steps. And he hasn't learned the first two steps, which is in the front of the textbook. In the first four chapters, he jumped over that. So he don't know the problem, and he don't know the solution. And he reads the first step, and he said, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, our lives, or become other man's. But he said, hell, I ain't powerless over nothing, because he ain't even read that part. And he said, come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. He says, hell, I ain't crazy. You know, and if you ain't powerless and you ain't crazy, you don't need a power greater than yourself. So really, you know, what we're going to be doing this weekend is really talking about, you know, the front part of the book, laying the foundation using the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, using it as a textbook. And if we use it as a textbook, we will find out the great simplicity of how this book, you know, can take any reader, if he's an alcoholic, and start him out at mathematics, increase his knowledge. And when he gets to chapter 5, if he fully absorbs these first four chapters, then when he gets to chapter 5, he will be able to use how it works, which is the algebra.
I think the other important point here, too, is that in the course of the revisions made for the second and third edition, the actual recovery portion of the book, which is the first 164 pages, has been left largely untouched. You know, in 1955, it became necessary, they felt, to change the stories in the back of the book to a certain extent. The first members, most of them were men, most of them were pretty low-bottom drunks, and most of them were up in years quite a ways. And they found in 55 that those original stories in the back of the book no longer accurately reflected the membership of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where the new reader gets identification. So they changed some stories in the back of the book. Took some out, added more in, changed them around, and came out with a second edition. Did the same thing in 1976. But the actual recovery portion, whether we're reading a first edition, second edition, or third edition, has remained basically the same. This blows my mind, too, to think that the book is now about 48 years old, and to think that we alcoholics have never yet changed it. But it has worked so good, we've been scared to death of even trying to change it. So whatever book you're reading, it doesn't make any difference. The recovery portion has remained identically the same. They did keep it the same. They did keep it from becoming garbled.
Joe? Okay, forward to the first edition. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book.
We are more than 100 men and women. When I read that, I think I'm alerted to the fact that this is not a one-person, one-author book. Usually when I read a book that has been authored by one person, with my keen intellectual alcoholic mind, if I disagree with what they're saying, I say, who in the hell are they to think they're smarter than I am? And I just ignore it. But if I do that with a big book, I'm going to be arguing with 100 men and women. They told Bill, we want you to write the book. But they said, as you write it, we want to see each chapter. We will add to, delete from, and change around whatever we want to. And when we're through, it'll be the collective knowledge, experience, and wisdom of all of us. Now, that was in 1937, 40 people. By the time the book was completed in 1939, that 40 had now become 100. So if I argue with the book today, I'm arguing with 100 people, not one, and those 100 people have recovered from the same thing that's killing me if I'm a practicing alcoholic. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Now, Joe and I have been around AA long enough to know that there's only one requirement to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's a desire to stop drinking. You know, you can stand up in this meeting tonight, and you can say, I don't like you people at all. Don't like those steps up there on the wall, and can just barely drink your lousy old coffee. But I'm going to be a member of AA because I've got a desire to stop drinking. And nobody can say a thing in the world about that. In fact, you don't even have to be sober to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It helps if you are, but you really don't have to be. But this book does not deal with membership and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. This book deals with one thing and one thing only, recovery from the disease of alcoholism. And the first 100 are going to show me precisely how they recovered. And if I follow their path, then surely I can receive what they received also, recovery from the disease of alcoholism. Not being cured, but recovering from the disease of alcoholism.
Okay. Let's go to forward to the second edition, Roman number 15. The spark that was to flare in the first AA group was struck in Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience. Following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford group of that day, he had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who is now counted no less than a medical saint by AA members, and whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. And this, you know, this kind of shows us where Bill got this from. Dr. Silkworth showed him what the problem, Eddie brought him the Oxford group program, his solution. From this doctor, the broker learned the grave nature of alcoholism. It's from Dr. Silkworth that he learned this. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford groups, he was convinced of the need for a moral inventory, professional personality defects, restitution of those harms, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief and dependence upon God. Prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on a theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic. Now, during this 6 months' time, from the time Bill had his experience until he made the trip to Akron, Bill worked hard with a lot of alcoholics. I mean, they said he was going around New York jacking them off the bar stools. And it's very ironic, you know. Now, Bill, this is the man who wrote the book. At this time, he was making the same mistake we talked about. He was jacking these drunks, trying to give him his planned program of recovery. He was trying to start them off in the fifth chapter. Now, he was telling them about his experience, trying to force this thing over on them. And just before that, just about at that time, he was before he went to Akron, he went by, changed by the hospital to see a drunk, and Dr. Silkworth was talking to him. And Dr. Silkworth told Bill, he said, Bill, I want to talk to you. He said, you need to quit going around here grabbing these drunks, trying to get them to take your this white hot flash you had. He said, why don't you explain to them what I explained to you? And then maybe they will buy into your program. And this was, you know, he must have been God sent, because this was just before he went to Akron. And when he got to Akron, the broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear that he might start drinking. He suddenly realized all to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. That alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. And as we look at this, you know, and get into the details of this meeting, as Charlie said, Dr. Bob was in the Oxford group. In fact, Dr. Bob had been in the Oxford group for 2.5 years. He was in the recovery program. Dr. Bob felt that the solution was spirituality, so he knew the second step. Dr. Bob had the second step, and he was involved in the 10 steps of recovery. But he didn't know what his problem was. It's very ironic. What Bill told him was his problem. Now, he said, this physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means. He was trying that to solve his alcohol dilemma, but failed. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and his hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never been able to muster. He sobered never to drink again up to the moment of his death in 1950. Now, once Bill told him what his problem was, then he was motivated to apply the program like he had been working, nothing new, but he recovered. Now, he says, it seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect an alcoholic as no non-alcoholic could. I also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. Hence, the two men set about frantically upon alcoholics arriving in the ward of the Akron City Hospital. Their very first case, a desperate one recovered, immediately became AA member number 3, and this was Bill Dodson. He never had another drink. This work at Akron continued through the summer in 1935. There were many failures, but occasionally heartening success. When the broker returned to New York in the fall of 1935, the first AA group had actually been formed, though no one realized it at that time. In late 1937, a number of members having substantially sobered at the time behind them was sufficient to convince the membership that a new light had entered the dark world of the alcoholic. And these few people, you know, they said, well, maybe we have something here. A second group had promptly taken shape. At New York, and besides, there were scattered alcoholics who had picked up the basic ideas in Akron and New York who were trying to form an AA group in other cities. It was now time the struggling group thought to place their message and unique experience before the world. And this was when the little group met and decided that they would do this. This determination bore fruit. In the spring of 1939, the publishing of this volume, and this book was published with their program in 1939 of 100 people at that time. The number of membership had reached 100 men and women. The fledgling society, which had been named, is now to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its book. And then really what happened, this 40 people, finally they decided to write the book. When they got the book finished, it was 100. And they went through a lot of exercises trying to find out, you know, at this time what to name their program. There were a lot of discussions about the book and a lot of discussions and many, many different arguments these people had about what to call this. It probably came out of the Cleveland group. I think it's where we know it originated, seemingly, from what we can hear. We're always trying to trace the AA history. And I tell them, how can you tell what a bunch of drunks was doing 40 years ago. I don't know what they were doing last week. You know, we'll get to the truth. But it was in the Cleveland group, I think, that the idea came out that we're alcoholics and we want to remain anonymous. Therefore, the name caught on, Alcoholics Anonymous. So they finally decided to call their program Alcoholics Anonymous. 40 people, 100 people, then they did their program and said, we're going to name the program Alcoholics Anonymous. So the Alcoholics Anonymous is the title of their book. And this is the first Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, after they named the book Alcoholics Anonymous, then these 100 people name themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. So there are two Alcoholics Anonymous. The first Alcoholics Anonymous is a textbook which contains a planned program of recovery from alcoholism. And the next Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship. Well, in 1939, quite obviously, since these people wrote the book, the program in the fellowship was exactly the same as the program in this book, because this is what it was. They wrote the book. So the book and the program were exactly the same in 1939. And as Charlie said, the book, thank God, is unchanged. But the fellowship program has changed. It don't even resemble the book much sometimes. They say go to meetings and don't drink. Put the plug in the jug. I don't, you know. It's a lot of stuff that we have come, because people change, don't they? People really change. And so we don't realize how people add to, dilute, and water down until where sometimes they don't even resemble what we really had when we started in 1939. Now, I always accept that's a challenge, and I like to do, that's what a big book study is all about for me, and I love to do it in my group, and I like to listen to my group. I like to listen to the fellowship I belong to. I like to compare the program in the fellowship in my group with the program in this book, you know, and see how far we away and we get away from what we really were. And this is what we're going to be talking about this weekend. We're not going to be discussing the program in the fellowship. We'd be here forever talking about that. We're going to be talking about the simple program that we have in our book, in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is the real Alcoholics Anonymous is in the book.
We got into a group not long ago, and we listened to a discussion of almost an hour on first, chemical dependency and what is it. Second, group depression and what causes it. And third, sexual dysfunction, and isn't that a shame? Now, those are valid things. You know, chemical dependency is a problem. Group depression is a problem. And surely sexual dysfunction is a problem also. But you know that people that wrote this book had the same problems. They were dependent upon a chemical called alcohol, and they had group depression also. And from what I can read in here, there was a hell of a lot of sexual dysfunction. Now, they found a practical program of action, and they applied the practical program of action in their lives, and the chemical dependency disappeared. And also the group depression disappeared. And in 9 cases out of 10, the sexual dysfunction got all right also. And I believe today in AA, if you and I would discuss the simple program of action in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, and if we would apply it in our life as the book says, then those things would also disappear today, just like they did back in the 1930s. Now, many people today in AA tend to blame the newcomers in AA for this problem. They say, well, that's what they learned in a treatment center or wherever they came from, and it's their fault. But I don't believe that's true. Certainly, they learned that wherever they came from. But that's the only thing they know to talk about. Now, I think the real problem in AA today is the older members are not saying, look, here's how you take care of those things. Here's how you solve them. You use the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, work the steps, make them a part of your life, and then those things are going to disappear. The newcomer only knows to talk about what they know to talk about. It's our responsibility to make sure that they understand about the steps and understand that the steps are designed to take care of those kind of problems, and then to help them with these steps so they can affect a recovery from the disease also. So I don't really blame the newcomer. I blame many of we older people in AA. If we would go to page 20, we would see Roman numeral 20. We would see what the percentage of recoveries used to be when they used the program in its pure form in the book. It said public acceptance of AA grew by leaps and bounds. For this, there were two principal reasons. The large numbers of recoveries and reunited homes. These made their impressions everywhere. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Now, it's evident that those that really tried this program in the beginning, a minimum of 75% of them recovered from the disease. I wonder what it is today. Is it 75% recovery rate today? Is it 50%? Is it 25%? Is it even 10%? No, I don't think so. Now, I realize a lot of people in AA today aren't really trying. And I realize a lot of them have been forced here against their will. But I also believe that if you and I would make sure that they know what to really try, that a hell of a lot of them would really try. But if they don't know what to try, then how in the hell are they going to really try? And I think that's our responsibility. Too many of we older members are saying, well, I can't communicate with those people, so I'm just going to go home and stay there. And when we do, we abdicate our responsibility. When we do that, we're letting the newcomers, who are the sickest of the sickest, supposedly in AA, determine what the program and the meeting is going to be. The older members that have recovered need to determine what the program is. And then say to the newcomer, this is how we recovered. And we'll be glad to help you understand it, and be glad to walk with you through it, glad to sponsor you as you go through this thing. And I believe we could see that recovery rate change tremendously today, if we do our job that we're supposed to do. Joe?
Yes, Al.
Now, we promise we won't preach anymore this weekend. That's all the preaching.
I'm not going to make that promise. You know, I get fascinated when I hear about this. You know, we always think, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous we're big today, and there were many, many people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our fellowships and our groups are growing. But still, you know, there's some, you know, I think that we need to look critical at ourselves and voice concerns about, you know, what, you know, because we're interested in the fellowship. You know, I always, somewhere in one of these early times, I like to bring up the idea that, you know, I here recently in studying and talking about the earlier movements, there was a movement called the Washingtonian Movement that was started by a group of alcoholics. And it was, it became immediately successful, and after a year they had 1,000 members. You know how long it took us, AA, to get 1,000? And the fellowship grew and grew and grew in this country at that time. I believe it was in 1840 that it started. And in a lot of different history books, we can read many things about it. We read about it and different ideas about, but it's, in some books it says that, sometimes in about 8 years, this group had grown, this fellowship had grown to 600,000 members in the United States. And we didn't have much of a population as we do now. And it was big and it was powerful. And it had spiritual concepts. And in the Washingtonians, in order to conduct their meetings, something to go on, they would ask members to get up and tell their stories. And the members would get up and start, and they would tell their drunk logs. This is where it started in the Washingtonians. And this thing grew and grew and grew. And it became a powerful fellowship. It had some spiritual concepts, and the people in the fellowship cared about each other. But they got involved in some things, and it's true that they didn't have traditions, and they got involved with the Prohibition movement, the other movements, and kind of lost their track. But the main reason the Washingtonians fell was not because they didn't have traditions. A lot of people think that. But the main reason the Washingtonians dissolved, and by then 12 years, they disappeared, and they never knew they existed on the face of this earth. But the main reason that fellowship dissolved was not because of tradition, but because they didn't have a program of recovery. They was just a fellowship. You know, and I feel that, you know, we should feel also that we're not guaranteed. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is not guaranteed. Because if we lose our program, we become a fellowship again, and we become a fellowship, we won't last either. So I think it's very, very important that the foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous is not the fellowship, but the program that we practice within that fellowship. That's the strength of the fellowship. Okay, going to the doctor's opinion.
Let me say one more thing about the newcomer, and then we'll leave it. First, I love him.
Yeah.
Because without the newcomer, there would be nobody to carry on after the old-timer's gone. But the thing I really love about the newcomer is they're forcing us back into our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, they really are.
That's right.
The communication thing is different. The fellowship is a different thing. And since the newer people today can't get the strength from the fellowship that the older members used to get from it, then they are looking for something that has power. And they're the ones putting us back in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We sense that. We see that everywhere we go. Thank God for the newcomers today.
Okay, now we're going to get down to Dr. Silkworth. What is the problem? And if we say this is the foundation of the book, the whole book is written on, after this, on the solution and how to recover from what he explains. And this is why the doctor's opinion is really the foundation of the big book. We say that the first step to recover from any illness is what is the problem. And most illnesses, you know, it's a professional that makes the diagnosis of the patient. But alcoholism is a unique illness. It's the only illness in which the patient has to make a self-diagnosis. No other illness is like this. And it's a very difficult thing to, it's first step, we don't realize how difficult it is. We are very blessed today. Those of us in Alcoholics Anonymous do not realize, I don't think most of us get the impact of how blessed we are. In fact, you know, the only alcoholics in the world are AA members.
That's right.
The rest of those people out there ain't alcoholics. We are the only alcoholics in the world. We're the only people who know we're alcoholics. Most of them people don't. Alcoholism is the only disease that tells the patient you ain't got it. Yeah, man. That's why you can tell who's got it. The one that swears he ain't got it's got it. Yeah. So we know we're the only people who know that we got it. Okay. And that's the first step of getting over something when you know you got it. Okay. So number one, Dr. Silkworth was the first person to show us this. Prior to this, no, the world did not understand alcoholism. We didn't know what the problem was. Dr. Silkworth told the world, and he discovered this, the problem of alcoholism, and we go all the way back to the beginning of mankind. History, the oldest recorded history of man that we know today is in the Bible. We may not like it, but it has the recording of the oldest discussion of the problem of alcoholism is in the Bible. Many, many discussions in there, but one of my favorite is in Proverbs 23:29 to the end that deals with Solomon is credited right in Proverbs, and this man had great wisdom, insight into human problems, and it seemed like people from all over his known world brought their problems to him. He was like the social worker of his day. Yeah. And someone asked him about one of us, and it is so beautiful the way he, you know, he said, who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has wounds without cause? They that tarry long at the wine. That's all they had in those days. Everybody was a wino in those days. They hadn't made that other stuff yet, you know. And he said, you know, he went on to describe what happens. Vivid. He said, you will be as one who lies down in the midst of a sea. You know, you sway around a lot. Or sleep at the top of a mast. I love that. And he said, you will say they have beaten me, and I felt it not. You know, the next morning you feel like somebody was beating on you. And he sure knew some of us fellows, because he said, thine eyes shall behold strange women. And thy heart shall utter perverse things. You know, you'll say a lot of things you don't want to say. But then I love the way he closed it. But he said, but still yet, they will rise in the morning and seek it yet again. You know, wisdom is a lasting thing. That description of alcoholism would fit the people in 1987. You know, it's a lasting thing. But he didn't understand the problem. None of the great minds down through history understood alcoholism, but they all applied solutions because they said it was a sin, so they prayed over them. They said it was a weakness. But no one ever saw it as a disease. Finally, you know, several doctors earlier, Dr. Benjamin Rush said it in 1784, and he was accredited to being the father of American psychiatry. He said he thought it was a disease process, but he couldn't explain it. And he said, I think the answer is total abstinence. He knew the solution. But no one really understood it. And Dr. Silkworth went to work at the towns and hospital in 1930. When Dr. Silkworth went to towns, alcoholism was accepted as probably a moral issue, or it was a weakness. And Dr. Silkworth went there and he began to work with alcoholics. Now, he didn't go there to do this. Dr. Silkworth went there because he couldn't find a job. It was during a depression. He had dreams of having his own little clinic, and you know, but he just couldn't do it, so he took a job working with drunks. You know, doctors just don't like to, you know, this guy didn't go to medical school to get out to go to work with alcoholics. Doctors don't do that, you know. So he took a job there. And he began to watch alcoholics. And he saw nobody get well. He saw people come all the time, leave, die, come back. He saw nobody recover. He saw no one recover. But even though people said they were weak, he began to accumulate a little idea about this. And he says that he began to, through observation, day in and day out of being and observing these people, he said he began to observe some power. He said there's something in these people that is driving them. There's something in them that is driving them to this destruction. And he began to accumulate this idea of a force, of a power in these people. And he began to split it into two parts. He said, I believe part of it is in their body, and I believe part of it is in their minds. And over a period of time, he was able to add to this as he studied each day, and he did it through observation. And this is what he gave to Bill. This is what he told Bill. He accumulated this over a period from 1930 to 1933 when he was working with Bill. And I don't know if Bill probably was the first alcoholic in the history of the world to really know what his problem was. As Dr. Silkworth said, this is my opinion, Bill. I've just been thinking about this, and this is my opinion of what this is. And it was published in the front of this book called The Doctor's Opinion. This is the way it started. And Bill took this opinion, and he got sober. And as a result of Bill getting sober, he carried it to Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob got sober. And they carried it on, and 100 people got sober. And after 100 people got sober, they put it in this book, and this book went out. 150,000 people got sober by 1956. And after 150,000 people got sober in 1956, as a result of this opinion, the American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association said alcoholism is a disease. And they proved the opinion with 150,000 people. The whole world accepts it. But where did it begin? It didn't begin in the medical journal. It began in the front of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we was talking a while ago. You know, they wanted to set up these hospitals. They wanted to hire paid missionaries. But they wrote the big book. And as a result of the big book, now we got the hospitals and the paid missionaries. But we didn't have to do it. Just look at what the doctor had to say. On Roman numeral 24, it says, the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. Yeah.
In this statement he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. Now, this is the first time we can find anywhere in written history a statement referring to the fact that the body is sickened also. Everything up until then dealt with the mind only. Weak will, moral character, sin, and etc. But here he's stating that the body is quite as abnormal as the mind. And there's a lot of information in that statement. What he's really saying is the body and the mind are both quite abnormal if we're an alcoholic. He said it did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. Now, if we are to use this as a textbook, then I think what we've got to be sure is that we always understand the words that the textbook is using. If the writer puts down a word, and he has one idea or definition of that word, and then I come along as the reader and I read that word, and I have a different idea or a different definition, then the information that I'm going to gain is not going to be the correct information. It will be garbled and incomplete. And I think probably the word allergy gave me more difficulty than anything else when I first came to AA. Because I came to AA and they said, Charlie, you're allergic to alcohol and you can't drink it anymore. You better quit. And I said, well, how in the hell can I be allergic to alcohol? I'm drinking a quart and a half a day. And how can you drink that much of something you're allergic to? Plus, I knew what an allergy was. I knew that an allergy always had some visible, physical manifestation. In other words, if you're allergic to strawberries and you eat them, you break out in a rash. And I didn't break out in a rash when I drank alcohol. I knew if you were allergic to milk and you drank it, you had a bad case of dysentery. Well, I didn't have a bad case of dysentery when I drank alcohol. Once in a while I would, depending on what I'd been drinking. But usually I didn't. I knew if you're allergic to ragweeds, you get around them, your eyes itch, your nose begins to itch, you sneeze, and so on and so forth. And I didn't do that when I drank alcohol. So I said, how in the hell can I be allergic to alcohol? I don't understand. And they said, Charlie, you don't need to understand. They said, all you need to know is just don't drink and you'll be okay. Well, today I know why they told me that is because they didn't understand either. They didn't know any more about it than I did. One day I had to go to the dictionary and I looked up the word allergy and several different definitions like with most words in the dictionary, but I found one that fits me perfect. It says an allergy is an abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, substance of any kind. An abnormal reaction. So I begin to try to see where I'm abnormal when it comes to alcohol. And you know, I didn't know what is abnormal. And I didn't know what's normal. Because the only thing I knew about drinking alcohol was the way I had been drinking it. And that had become absolutely normal to me. And all the people who drank with me drank the same way I did, or I didn't drink with them. So that kind of drinking was normal to me. But then I realized, no, that can't be what they're talking about. It must be talking about those people that don't get drunk. So I began to go to talk to those normal, social, temperate, moderate drinkers. Those that don't have any trouble with alcohol. And they tell me, most of them, that they can have a drink or two before dinner, be tired, tense, wrought up from the day's work, have a drink or two and they get kind of a relaxed feeling. And then they'll go ahead and eat dinner, and they probably won't drink any more that night. Well, now, I don't feel that way when I drink alcohol at all. You know, I take a drink of alcohol, and it passes over my lips, and my lips begin to tingle a little bit. And it hits my teeth, and they start to chatter up and down. And it hits my tongue, and it begins to grow and swell. And my cheeks begin to billow in and out. And I can feel it passing up through my sinus cavities into my forehead, and I get a feeling in my forehead which is absolutely indescribably wonderful. Now, I haven't even swallowed the damn stuff yet. I just got it in my mouth. And when I swallow it, as it goes down through my esophagus, I feel some great things start taking place. Number one is my chest begins to grow and expand and get bigger and bigger. And it hits my stomach, and it just literally explodes like a bomb. I can feel it racing up through my arms, and they get longer and longer, and it hits my hands and my fingers, and they begin to tingle and vibrate. And at the same time, it's racing through my legs, and as it does, I get taller and taller, and it hits my feet and my toes, and they get that hot, burning, exciting, get up and go somewhere and do something feeling. I don't understand a little relaxing feeling from out there. Now, that's one way I'm different. I find out today that 9 people out of 10, they don't feel the way I feel whenever I drink. Now, the reason I love to drink is because of the way it makes me feel. It makes me feel different than it makes the normal person feel. That's one way I'm different. But the way I'm really different is this. All these normal, social, moderate, temperate drinkers, they tell me, they say, we have 1 or 2 drinks. And they say, we get a slightly tipsy, out of control, nauseous feeling. And they say, we don't like that feeling. We don't like that out of control feeling. We don't like the nauseous feeling. Therefore, 1 or 2 or 3 drinks is all we want to drink. Well, today I understand that that is a normal reaction to alcohol. Alcohol is a toxic drug. It's a destroyer of human tissue. And the mind and body can recognize what's put into it. And if it's going to harm the body, the first thing that happens is it says, let's puke this stuff up and get it the hell out of here. But we alcoholics don't get that feeling. We don't get a slightly tipsy, out-of-control, nauseous feeling. We get an exciting, in-control. And in place of the nauseous feeling, a physical craving for more of the same. Now, the physical thing in normal social drinkers is to vomit it up. The physical thing for you and I is to crave more physically. And that craving is so strong in the body that it overcomes the ability of the mind to stop us after we have once started. You know, most normal social drinkers drink all they want to drink every time they drink. Now, I always thought they had to use willpower to not drink more than 1, 2, or 3. But I realize today that isn't true. They get all they want every time they drink. I drank alcohol 26 years. I never did get all I wanted to drink. A hell of a lot more than I needed many, many times. But never did I get all I wanted to drink. That's the difference between me and the normal social drinker. About the time they quit drinking, that's just when I'm ready to start drinking after 1, 2, or 3 drinks. We are completely abnormal when it comes to alcohol, Joe.
As Charlie says, the normal social drinker, when he gets the effects of alcohol, he's ready to quit. And the alcoholic, when he gets the effects of alcohol, he's ready to start. Just the opposite. So, he goes over on the next page in Roman numeral 26. Once he tells us something in here, well, find that book will always do this in talking and teaching the person, you know, how, you know, you start off and then you reinforce your points. You know, I love the way the text teaches. It starts you off and then it gives you illustration and then it goes further and further with the same point. We believe, as so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is within this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. You know, we are the only people who crave alcohol. Normal people do not crave alcohol. And this is what, you know, I can't, you know, I didn't know that I was like Charlie. I didn't know I was an abnormal drinker because I had always drank abnormally all my life, and abnormal was normal for me. Now, it says that there's some words in here, chronic alcoholics. I didn't like that word. I didn't know what it meant, but it just sounded bad, chronic.